Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, July 1st, 2014, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our Courthouse Steps telephone conference call will be discussing the Harris versus Quinn labor law case decided yesterday by the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. We welcome to today two experts for our call. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of them of about 8 to 10 minutes, after which we'll have a little bit of back and forth and then questions from you, the audience. We're going to hear first from Andrew M. Grossman. He's an associate at Baker & Hostetler and an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute, both right here in Washington, D.C. He will be followed in his opening remarks by Professor Samuel Bagenstos. He is a professor at the University of Michigan Law School. And with that, Mr. Grossman, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Great. Thank you, Dean. Our subject today is yesterday's really big decision, and let's be clear, it was not Hobby Lobby. Harris v. Quinn, I think, promises to be one of the most consequential decisions of this past term, and perhaps it may be the most important in terms of its immediate effects and the long-term doctrinal consequences. To make things easy, I'll begin by discussing the legal and factual background for the case, and then offer a few thoughts about what I think it all means. Now, to begin with, Harris works really on two different levels. There's what the court held and what it signaled about the future of public sector unions and public workers' First Amendment rights. Now, the court has long held that the First Amendment's protections of freedom of speech and freedom of association include freedom from government coercion to speak, freedom from coerced support of another person's speech, and freedom from coerced associations. So the question is when, if ever, can a state require that workers channel their speech regarding matters of public interest through a labor union? When can they be forced to pay to support a labor union speech on those issues? And when can they be forced to associate with that union? Now, in a 1977 case called Abood v. Detroit Board of Education, the court held that a state could force its own workers to do those things because it has a compelling interest in maintaining labor peace and the subsidiary need to avoid free riders. That is, workers who receive the benefits of collective bargaining without paying for union representation. Labor peace, the court explained, encompasses all the difficulties of having to negotiate and reach agreement with a wide variety of workers who might hold a wide variety of potentially irreconcilable views on how the workplace ought to be run. Instead, a government employer can negotiate with just a single labor union, which would then represent all workers, whether or not all of those workers agreed with it on every particular issue or not. Now, for this to work, the union has to represent every single worker, and it has to do so neutrally, without discriminating against workers who do not join the union. Those non-members can therefore be required to pay a so-called agency fee to the union to cover its collective bargaining expenses. But the big question in Harris, is somewhat narrower. What happens when the workers at issue don't really look like state employees at all? Can the state still require them to support a labor union? In 2003, the state of Illinois decided to recognize home care workers receiving subsidies through its rehabilitation program as state employees, but only for purposes of collective bargaining. The law is actually quite clear that they're not considered to be state employees for any other purposes, such as receiving state worker benefits, or even subjecting the state to liability for their actions. The law is also clear that the state is not responsible for hiring, firing, or supervising these workers, for controlling the facilities in which they work, which are, after all, in many instances, the workers' own homes, or even for evaluating their performance. Those things are all done either by the recipients of the home care or by their guardians. The state recognized the SEIU, a labor union, as these workers' exclusive representative, and so now they have to pay the union to bargain with the state over the very narrow range of things that the state actually does control, basically just wages, and those are set in any case by law. About a dozen states have adopted similar requirements for home-based workers, including home health aides and child care workers, many of whom care for family members and receive modest subsidies from the state for doing so. Now, that was the subject of the precise ruling in Harris. According to the majority opinion, those kinds of requirements are, quote, a very substantial expansion of Abood's reach. What justifies the agency, an agency fee, the court explained, is the fact that a state compels the union to promote and protect the interests of non-members while it promotes labor peace through its collective bargaining activities. But in this instance, the union has precious little authority to bargain because the state controls so very few aspects of the employment relationship. The major one that it does control, pay, is set by statute. And as the court explains, if these workers could be made to associate with and to support a union, so could every recipient of state subsidies. And Abood's reasoning doesn't extend anywhere near that far. Moreover, generally applicable First Amendment principles prohibit the government from forcing individuals to fund the speech of other private speakers, absent some compelling government interest. But as the court observes, even if collective bargaining by an exclusive representative like a labor union is necessary to achieve labor peace, it's far from clear that that requires that all employees join the union or pay union fees. Indeed, federal workers, postal service workers, and workers in so-called right-to-work states get to choose whether or not to join or to support a labor union, and the result, needless to say, has not exactly been chaos. As with home workers, it's not even apparent that there's any labor peace interest here at all. There's no common workplace, no common job assignments, and little possibility of the kind of industrial discord that underlies the whole idea of labor peace and that motivated union membership requirements to begin with. So the bottom line, according to the majority, is that the state of Illinois may not require its home care workers to pay fees to a labor union, although of course they may choose to do so. Now, that's what the court held, but equally notable is what it did not hold, and that's whether or not Abood remains good precedent. The court could avoid answering that question because of its holding that the workers here are not state employees at all. At the same time, the majority devotes a substantial portion of its opinion to describing what it calls, quote, Abood's questionable foundations. Five justices now have signed on to the view that Abood was wrong as originally decided, that it's inconsistent with First Amendment doctrine in the court's case law, and that it is unworkable in practice because of the enormous practical difficulties of protecting the First Amendment rights of workers who disagree with the labor union. Now, these objections aren't arbitrary ones. They track the criteria that the court typically applies in deciding whether or not to overrule one of its precedents. Now, that is, it seems to me, certainly not an accident. So where does this leave us? Now, over the past decade, about a dozen states or so have enacted requirements similar to the one in Illinois, declaring home care workers to be state employees for purposes of collective bargaining and for union representation. This was a key area of growth for labor unions, and it was expected to help them offset continuing membership declines in the private sector. From around about a zero a decade ago, several hundred thousand home care workers now are covered by collective bargaining agreements. After Harris, many of those workers will be able to choose whether or not to financially support a labor union. Now, that's not going to happen overnight. There's going to be litigation, and states and unions will argue that their programs are materially different and that Harris doesn't apply. The full results of Harris could take a few years to shake out, and in many instances, labor unions will continue to represent home care workers whom they already do as workers choose to accept that representation. Other workers will choose that they do not care to continue paying for that sort of representation. But I think one thing is clear is that this will slow, if not end outright, future state-based programs targeting home care workers. These were premised on the type of arrangements that states like Illinois had adopted, and now that arrangement seems in general to be off the table. The bigger question is what is the fate of Abood and its continuing relevance in labor law? Harris strongly suggests that Abood is not long for this world, and I think that's right so long as the court retains its current composition. Harris was a warning shot. In the same way that the court's campaign finance decision in Wisconsin Right to Life prefigured Citizens United, and in the same way that its voting rights decision in Northwest Austin prefigured the results in Shelby County. This has been a hallmark of the Roberts Court, signaling to give the ability to the democratic process to work things out, as well as for the law to fall into line, signaling its view on broader legal questions that it may choose to reach in subsequent cases. I think the interesting thing here is that the end of Abood, which is to say the end of coercing public workers to support labor unions, may actually come sooner than many people expect. Currently pending before the Ninth Circuit is a case called Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association, and it directly raises the question of whether Abood remains good law. The plaintiffs in that case are public school teachers, and there is no way to avoid the central question of Abood's continuing relevance. There is no opportunity for a narrower ruling. After all, the plaintiffs in Abood were also public school teachers. Friedrichs isn't moving fast enough to make it to the Supreme Court for the next term, the 2014 term, which begins this coming October. But it should in all likelihood be ready in the next year, in the subsequent year. That means we could see a final decision regarding Abood's continued relevance by June 2016, just 2 short years from now. My view is, that the court's doubts are well-founded. The court's precedents didn't really support the results in Abood, and that's something that's well recounted by the Harris majority. More to the point, the kind of paternalistic impulse underlying the holding in Abood is something that the court in recent decades has rejected in a series of cases in many different domains, from commercial speech to associational rights cases. As the court has focused more diligently and more technically developed its First Amendment doctrine, these different strands have become apparent, and at this point it's fairly clear that Abood is a bit of an outlier. The more difficult question is where this leaves private sector union arrangements such as the Railway Labor Act, the National Labor Relations Act, and that's a difficult question, and I think the court in Harris went to some length and took great pains to suggest that this may be something that applies only in the public sector, and that really only Abood is at risk. I think the doctrinal developments we'll see in coming years will indicate whether or not that's the case. So thank you, and with that, I will turn it over to Professor Bagenstos.
Thanks a lot. And let me say thank you to those of you who are listening and to the Federalist Society for hosting me to speak about this. I'll just say a few words. I think that Andrew laid out the background, and I just want to kind of focus on some of the key takeaways from the case and maybe some concerns that I have with it. So the first point I think to make, just in a sort of prefatory sense, is the effect of the Harris decision on representation of workers who provide home-based services is really unclear. And I think that's something that Andrew sort of suggested by saying that perhaps this free rider justification isn't all it's cracked up to be. We will see whether this has much of an effect on the efforts by labor unions to unionize the workers who provide state-supported services to people in their own homes. And I think that that's very much an open question, an interesting empirical question, but not something we're really going to know about very soon. I think the more interesting questions from the perspective of looking at this decision yesterday are questions about what this does to the law, and that's basically what Andrew's focus was, and I'll also focus on that. So obviously the top line, the court didn't overrule the Abood case. The court just limited Abood to cases involving what the court called for the first time, you know, effectively real public employees, not this new term, partial public employees. But as Andrew said, and I think this is right, the court suggested that if the composition of the court remains the same at the time the court is called upon to actually decide again whether Abood is good law, and they were called upon to do that in this case, and they avoided the question, if the court's composition remains the same, it looks like it's just a matter of time for Abood. Now, a lot can change. A lot can change about the composition of the court. A lot can change about an issue when the court actually confronts it. As I said, the court was asked in a very aggressive brief by the petitioner in this case to overrule Abood, and the court didn't do that, notwithstanding ticking off, as Andrew says, many of the criteria for overruling a case. And I think one can look at this and say, well, maybe the court wasn't ready actually to overrule the case. After all, 2 years ago in the Knox case, Knox versus SEIU, the court had also sent a pretty strong signal that Abood might be on shaky ground, and everybody saw this case as the case that was the Shelby County to that case's Northwest Austin, and yet the court didn't do it here. So What can we take away from this case? Well, let me offer a couple of criticisms. One is focused on the limitation of Abood that the court adopted in this case, and the other is focused on the criticisms of Abood in general. So it's the limitation of Abood that the court adopted in this case. I would submit it doesn't make any sense if one takes Abood seriously. So what Abood is based on, and the idea that it's constitutional to collect an agency fee from non-members of a bargaining unit is based on, is the idea that there is a state law that provides a union the power to serve as the exclusive representative of all the employees in a bargaining unit. That creates a correlative duty of fair representation to every member of the bargaining unit. So everything that the union does has to serve everybody in the bargaining unit, whether they choose to be members of the union or not. Of course, nobody is forced to be a member of a union in the United States. But the question is, those who are not members of a union but who are represented by that union and who benefit from their actions, may they be required to pay their fair share of the costs of collective bargaining, of the thing they benefit for? And what Abood says is, so long as the fee that is collected is germane to the collective bargaining relationship, to the negotiation of terms and conditions of employment, and to the administration of grievances and the like, and is not used for other more broadly political actions, then it is constitutional to collect this fee. And that is actually exactly what was going on in this case. So you had a bargaining representative selected by the workers in the bargaining unit pursuant to a state law that made them the exclusive bargaining representative, that provided this duty of fair representation to everybody, and that was authorized to collect from non-members, from those who chose not to be members, a proportionate fee accounting for the cost of collective bargaining. There was no question in this case, no allegation as the case got to the Supreme Court, that the fees were being used for any broader political issues. They were being used for collective bargaining. The fact that the public employees here were people who don't work all in the same facility, but instead work in a dispersed way in other people's homes, and the fact that the state law, in deference to the very strongly articulated concerns of people with disabilities, gave people with disabilities substantial power to select their own personal assistants from within the group of people qualified by the state and to direct them on a day-to-day basis, doesn't change the fact that we have the same free rider problem, we have the same exclusive representation issue as was at issue in Abood. If the court is going to say Abood does not extend to employees like these, I think it's really based on a deep concern with Abood itself, and I don't think Andrew would disagree with that. That is, the court would not have gotten to the place where it did here if the court, a majority of the court, were not concerned that Abood itself is shaky. And so that's what sends the signal that in the next case, perhaps Abood may not exist anymore if the composition of the court remains the same. And I would suggest that if the court were to overrule the longstanding authority to collect an agency fee, a fair share fee, in the public employee context, that would be something that's deeply problematic and would raise serious concerns with its general First Amendment jurisprudence. I'd say first, I think there's a very powerful argument made actually by Eugene Volokh just in the last 24 hours about this. The suggestion, and if you look on his blog, I think it's very nicely laid out, the suggestion that by asking me or requiring me to spend money that gets used to support somebody else's speech, that that's a First Amendment violation. It is something that's accepted in the case law, but the idea that my money used to support somebody else's speech violates my First Amendment rights is actually quite difficult to explain. As Eugene points out in his very well-done blog post, my tax money goes all the time to support speech that I disagree with, and so does the tax money of every person sitting on this phone call. And the distinction between money being forced my money being used to support speech that I don't like and that I disagree with when the speech is performed by a government agency versus a private entity is not a distinction that actually has a lot of First Amendment principle behind it. But that aside, I mean, this is a longstanding feature of the law, but it's a problematic one. That aside, I think there's a much more difficult doctrinal problem with overruling Abood, and Justice Kagan pointed this out a bit in her dissent yesterday. Justice Alito, I think, did not have a very effective answer to it. And the difficulty is that in its jurisprudence of public employee speech, the Supreme Court in recent years has consistently articulated a distinction between public employee speech taken as a citizen and public employee speech taken as an employee. Speech as a citizen, the court has said in cases like Duryea versus Garneri and Garcetti versus Ceballos, gets relatively full First Amendment protection, although adjusted downward for the proprietary needs of the government to run an operation that's efficient and effective. But speech as an employee, the court has said, does not get that kind of First Amendment protection. And the kind of speech that we're talking about here, the kind of speech that agency fees are used to support, is quintessential speech as an employee and not as a citizen. Under this jurisprudence, it's speech about terms and conditions of employment, about particular grievances. If the court is going to say that there is a First Amendment violation when my money as a government employee is used to support the union that represents me in negotiating terms and conditions of employment and adjusting my grievances, it's going to have to confront the fact that it's giving me more First Amendment rights to be free from my money going to a union than it is giving me First Amendment rights to actually speak out without fear of retaliation. And that's something the court has not yet confronted. I think some of the briefing in this case for the first time asked the court to confront that question, and I think that may be one reason why, although everybody thought after Knox, Abood would be going down in this case, the court shied away from it here. But in any event, obviously it's a very interesting and serious set of questions, and it's going to raise a lot of questions that will be litigated in future cases, as Andrew said. And I'm very interested and happy to talk in our discussion. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Professor. I want to revert to Andrew Grossman momentarily. Before I do that, let's let people begin to queue up with any questions they might have. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, you can indicate so by pushing the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go back to Andrew Grossman, where we started, to see if you have any response. And in particular, I'm interested in your thoughts on the differences between what's happening here and what happens when a taxpayer is forced to pay taxes for government-sponsored speech, what the distinction in your mind might be. But please feel free to address anything that Professor Bagenstos mentioned.
Sure. I thought Professor Bagenstos' comments were very astute. I'd just like to address two. One is, you know, sort of the workability and the sensibility of what he describes as a limitation of Abood. You know, I guess it's you know, depending on how you frame it, it's either a limitation of Abood's holding, or as the majority framed it, you know, that the state of Illinois was trying to extend and expand Abood's holding. Either way you look at it, I think there is actually some sense to it, because while the Abood did talk about the free rider argument, it was also clear, I think, that the free rider point wasn't everything. The free rider argument was subsidiary to this labor peace argument, and labor peace is something that the court, you know, it's really sort of a doctrine of happenstance. The court first started talking about this in Commerce Clause cases that involved, you know, massive industrial strikes and fire bombings and all kinds of industrial violence and the complete shutting down of the instrumentalities of interstate commerce in a lot of these early railroad cases. And that's the doctrine that in Abood the court borrowed to justify what it recognized to be at least somewhat of an imposition on First Amendment rights. But beginning with Abood, it reshaped that. to focus on the idea of kind of the mundane day-to-day discord of employer-employee relations. The different groups of employees may ask for different things. The government employers may be damaged and public services may be damaged by strikes and disagreements. And the government may find it very difficult to accommodate disparate demands by competing unions, for example, in a particular workplace. If you define labor peace to encompass those things, there is some point at which you may still have a free rider argument, because there are always free riders. Whenever anyone campaigns for any kind of public policy, there are always other people who may benefit by it. But at some point, the labor peace interest becomes a little bit tenuous. And so it is a difficult line drawing exercise, I'll acknowledge, to figure out exactly where that is. But I think a lot of the guideposts that the court identified here are pretty sensible ones if you look at the court's jurisprudence over the past 3.5 decades. You have a particular workplace, you have supervision, day-to-day supervision of the workers, you have a grievance process with respect to the supervisor. All these different things add up to the union operating in a role that, at least theoretically under the rationale of Abood, could promote labor peace. And I think that that concept, that idea, is something that's missing here. So I think one could quibble about where the line is drawn, but clearly the line does have to be drawn somewhere. And to my mind, and I think to the majority's view as well, it makes sense to do it in a way that observes practical realities as well as First Amendment interests. And the only other point I would note is the one that Dean raised as well. It's a really interesting conundrum, this distinction we have between government speech and private sector compelled speech. Obviously, the government can tax you and then spend that money on just about any manner of speech in its role as sovereign. To some, this seems like a formalistic distinction, because the government could potentially achieve the same result via taxes that it might currently achieve now through a compelled support of a labor union. It can tax the same amount of money of its workers and then transfer that money directly to a labor union. And wouldn't the result be exactly the same? Well, I don't think that's exactly right, because there's a practical difference, as the court has recognized in its government speech cases, particularly the ones involving commercial speech, in terms of how government speech actually operates versus how private speech actually operates, who controls it, the processes that it goes through, and what it says in terms of associational rights, in terms of support and endorsement of the message. So it's a little bit of a formalistic distinction, because on the face of it, it seems like you could do the same thing. But as a practical matter, I think that distinction actually does hold. It actually isn't equivalent. That said, I do appreciate the point, and I think that's something that perhaps we would discuss further if there are any questions along those lines.
All right, Professor Bagenstos, do you want to respond before we turn to the audience?
No, happy to talk to the audience.
Okay, we've got a couple questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take our first question.
This is Ray Lajeunesse, Vice President and Legal Director at the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. Our attorneys represented Pam Harris and the other plaintiffs in Harris v. Quinn, and we've got other cases pending against some of the, there's more than a dozen similar schemes in other states. I'm wondering, Andrew, you suggested that unions and states might try to distinguish those other schemes, but I wonder what types of arguments they could be making.
Sure. I think my biggest concern about implementation of this particular decision, I think that, as I said, the court had to draw the line somewhere, and I think the place that it drew it was pretty sensible. But in a sense, it over-egged the pudding, because the opinion described a number of factual circumstances present with respect to this Illinois law that it viewed as justifying its conclusion that these workers are not truly state employees. And that includes that includes how they're supervised, how they're hired and fired, the way that their work plans are developed, the fact that the state is not liable for any torts that they commit while on the job, the fact that they're not eligible for state benefits the way every single other state employee generally is. And in their calculus, you put all those things together, and that indicates that these are not state workers in the way that Abood contemplated. Fine. But every single one of those things, every single one of those guideposts is something that's going to be challenged in subsequent cases. Well, maybe in a California law, maybe they do get a couple different benefits. Maybe they are subject to, you know, the state is subject to tort liability. There are a million different ways that a state could design a program that is fundamentally identical to the one that Illinois had here, but differs ever so slightly in its factual specifics. And, you know, given the amount of money involved and given the underlying political interests, it seems to me that the states, as well as the labor unions, will have every possible interest in litigating these questions rather than simply acceding to the thrust of Harris.
And I'll just say about that, this is Sam Bagenstuss, it is certainly the case that the category of what's a partial public employee that comes out of this opinion is an unclear one. It's unclear because we don't know how many of the various differences from the what's basically an implicit model of a pure public employee are enough to move an employee off out of the public employee category and into the partial public employee category. So I think that Andrew is certainly right to that extent that there will be fights over, you know, how many different bargainable aspects of the relationship are necessary to make someone a pure public employee. Is the fact that somebody is working outside of a congregate facility enough to make them always a partial public employee or not? Right. So there will be lots of questions like this that will be litigated. Let me just say, from the perspective that I have in a lot of my life as a person who works on disability rights issues, that one very bad consequence from the perspective of people with disabilities and disability rights advocates of this decision might well be to encourage states to take more control over the day-to-day work of people who provide personal assistance services to people with disabilities. And one of the really historic efforts of people with disabilities organizing as a movement was to create personal assistance service systems in which the personal assistant really works for the person with a disability and really is directed on a day-to-day basis by that person, is not paternalistically controlling their lives. And this collective bargaining regime was a way of maintaining good wages and good benefits and avoiding turnover in those jobs while at the same time promoting the independence of people with disabilities. And what I fear will happen, and obviously people will differ as to whether this will happen and whether they fear it, but what I fear will happen as a result of this decision is pressure on states to avoid the aspects of their regimes that gave independent decision-making authority to people with disabilities. And I think that would be very problematic.
If I could ask a follow-up, if the lower courts were to find that in one of these other similar schemes, the providers were actually public employees, real public employees, would not then that case present the question when it reaches the court of whether Abood should be overruled?
Certainly. You know, the problem, though, as I think it becomes apparent, is that, you know, when the courts do decide things that, you know, in that manner, and it presents, you know, relatively similar factual circumstances to Harris, let's say somewhere halfway between the factual circumstances of Harris, where you have these quasi-governmental employees or not governmental employees, and the circumstances of Abood, where you've got public school teachers, where it's somewhere in between, that's the kind of case that may not be very interesting to the court. That said, you know, perhaps in the right circumstances, it could be grounds for a summary reversal.
That was Andrew Grossman. Professor Bagenstuss, do you have a comment on this?
No.
Okay. Well, I have a quick question. And by the way, for our audience, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. What I'm reading about the case, this is Dean Reuter in the newspapers, and I'm no expert, obviously, is that an executive order by the governor made these people in the Illinois case in Harris versus Quinn state employees for the purposes of unionization. Did the court... first of all, is that correct? And was that important in the court's decision? Did they take umbrage with the idea that there's something of a legal fiction here in the creation of a class of employees merely for the purpose of unionizing them? So that's the question.
Well, this is Andrew Grossman responding. It's certainly, you know, a colorful fact of this case that the state of Illinois had actually resisted pressure to promote collective bargaining for these particular programs for a number of years until Governor Blagojevich came into office and took the first step, as you described, with an executive order. Now, my understanding is that was subsequently ratified by legislative action in the state, and that's ultimately what the state, what the Supreme Court considered. But it does highlight, some of the colorful cronyism that sometimes takes place, with these types of organizational movements. The state labor board had held a decade before the organization of the workers at issue here that these workers were not in fact employees of the state, and that the state, should regard them in other ways and should treat them as subsidy recipients. And that's something that was really the prevailing view of the state until Blagojevich rode into office, on the support, on the very heavy support of a lot of labor unions who potentially stood to benefit from this kind of decision. That said, I don't think it made the least bit of difference with respect to the decision. It's just sort of a colorful aspect of it. One other point that I would note, though, is that in the states that have recognized this type of collective bargaining for home child care workers as opposed to home health services workers, I think all or nearly all of those have been done by executive order. To date, that's been a very difficult sort of proposition to get through the legislative process. And so where there has been a labor union interest in promoting collective bargaining in those areas, they have had to achieve it, working with their allies in state executive offices.
So this is Sam Bagginstuss. Yeah. So just a couple of things to add to that. In the dozen or so states that have regimes like this for collective bargaining of people who work in people's homes for the Medicaid program, you see the regimes getting adopted in any number of different ways. I mean, so sometimes it's by executive order, sometimes it's by legislation, sometimes it's by one then the other. In a number of states, there have been state constitutional amendments and laws passed by referendum. So it's really a sort of diverse way in which these regimes make their way into state law. And, I do think there are differences among each of these regimes, which goes back to the earlier question that may play into future litigation around them. I'm not sure that the way they entered state law is one of the salient differences. Just as a basic kind of federalism matter, I'm not sure that it's a proper question for First Amendment purposes, whether a state chooses to make this part of its state law through executive order or through legislation or through referendum or a constitutional amendment. But I do think, there is an interesting point about the different ways in which these regimes have made their way into state law.
All right, we've got one question pending, and then our lines will be wide open. If you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another caller.
I prefer to remain anonymous for the purposes of this call, and I'm certainly not a labor law expert, but I do spend a significant portion of my time providing home health care and other services to a seriously handicapped brother. I'm also a resident of the city of Chicago and the state of Illinois. First, let me say I'm highly skeptical that Governor Quinn's executive order, whether or not ratified by the legislature, has anything to do with providing benefits to labor, either organized or unorganized, but has more to do with drumming up funds to drive out votes for a certain political party in the state of Illinois. Second, I'd like to say that I find it a very peculiar view of individual liberty that says that looking after a handicapped relative makes you a state employee for any purpose whatsoever. But my question for the professors, if I heard the comments earlier correctly, was one or the other said that no one can be forced to join a union. And that does not seem to be the case in Chicago, Illinois, either de facto or de jure. So I'd like to ask the speakers if they would care to educate me and any of the rest of the audience as to the authority for that proposition, so that I will be well armed with that in the future.
Yeah, I mean, so this is Sam Bagenstaff. So just, you know, a couple of quick points about this. I mean, as to no one can be forced to join a union, we have a recognized doctrine of freedom of association that people can't be forced to join an association like that that they don't want to join. Now, there's a distinction, and it's an important distinction in the law, and it's a distinction that Abood draws, as well as a long line of other cases in the labor law context, both inside and outside the public sector, which is a distinction between being forced to join a union, and that's a voluntary decision to join a union, and
it is
being
absolutely counterfactual. Chicago, Illinois.
Well, so, you know, I'm just trying to describe what the law is. The distinction between being forced to join a union and being compelled when you work in a bargaining unit that has chosen a representative, that has voted to choose a representative in collective bargaining that represents the entire unit, being forced to pay a fair share fee, to pay your fair share of the costs of collective bargaining. And what Abood says is that's something that can be required. That's something that can be required to avoid this free rider problem. I think, you know, there are a lot of, you know, there are 10 million stories in the Naked City, and I think it wouldn't be productive to talk about individual ones, but and certainly there are cases where there are cases we can talk about, but I think there's a common misconception that being required to pay the fair share fee, which is just a fraction of union dues, is the same thing as being compelled to join a union. On another point, and I think this is also an important point, which is who are the people who are providing services under the Medicaid program that is represented by the unions in this collective bargaining regime. And many of them, and it really depends on the state, I mean, Illinois has one set of statistics, other states have others, many are, like yourself, relatives of the people they're providing services to. And that's actually one of the terrific aspects of this program, is it supports families of people with disabilities to take care of their family members at home, not to have to put them in institutions like they used to. This is an important thing, but many are not family members. There are many people with various kinds of disabilities who don't have family members who can provide services to them. And there are many people with various kinds of disabilities, often physical disabilities, but also certain kinds of mental disabilities, who don't want to mix the role of a loving family member, a parent who's likely to be paternalistic, and the role of someone providing them services. And so a significant fraction of the people who are providing services under this system are people who are not family members. They're just people who, they're workers. They're ordinary workers. And what this collective bargaining regime does is it allows all the people providing services under each program to vote as to whether they want to have union representation. If a majority wants union representation, the union can negotiate a contract that collects this fair share fee. It can't require membership, although, again, that's a distinction that, you know, that's a distinction that is sometimes a difficult one to see, but it's an important one in the law.
Right. This is Andrew Grossman. If I could just add 2 points. One, you know, with respect to different types of union arrangements, what Professor Bagenstaff was describing is commonly called an agency shop arrangement, where a worker gets to choose whether or not to join the union, but has no choice as to whether or not to financially support that union's collective bargaining activities. There are also, and it varies by industry and it varies under different regimes, different types of union arrangements that are known as closed shops and union shops. In some instances where dispatching for certain industries in a particular area is only out of people who are already members for that area. So if you're trying to hire an electrician, for example, in New York City, you're going to have to call up the union shop most likely, and you know, you're going to have to get someone who's a member, and it's going to be very difficult for you to get somebody outside of that. And then there are union shops where when somebody joins, they need not be a member of the union, but they ultimately have to join. I agree with Professor Bagenstaff that most in just about every sector at this point, you have agency shop arrangements. That said, I certainly agree with the caller that in some agencies or some industries and some workplaces, whether or not to join the union, although technically speaking, it may be the worker's choice, as a realistic matter, may not be. Yeah, and with respect, and then a second point, you know, the family member issue. You know, it's very interesting. The lead plaintiff in this case, Pamela Harris, is a participant in Illinois' disability program, which in the end is something that the court decided her challenge to that program was not ripe because the workers in that program never voted to elect a collective bargaining agent. In other words, they were not unionized at the time the case was brought and still have not yet been. There certainly is you know, a wide variety of arrangements you know, as to the types of people who carry out this type of home care work. Sometimes it's family members, sometimes it isn't, and there are a wide variety of reasons for that. But I think that was a really interesting sort of driving factor, you know, for this case that made it such an interesting case, is that there were a number of parents involved in both programs. And when people understood that these parents, you know, who were caring for their children or caring or family members who were caring for siblings or parents, that they were being forced to associate with and to give up some of the relatively minor subsidies they were receiving to a labor union. And in exchange for that, they weren't really getting back what to them seemed to be anything of value. That was something I think just clicked with a lot of people. I don't think it made the least bit of difference for the court's reasoning or result, but it's certainly something that drove a lot of public interest in the case.
Once again, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone to join the conversation. Let's take another question.
Hi, this is Glenn Taubman, a staff attorney with the National Right to Work Foundation. And I have sort of a philosophical question that I would throw out there. And I guess the question is, whatever happened to liberalism and the First Amendment? You know, once upon a time, you had these people who were called paragons of the First Amendment, like Justice Douglas and Justice Black, and they penned these wonderful opinions like Justice Black's fabulous dissent in Street and Justice Douglas and Lathrop and others. And they were lauded in the media and by the liberals and the left as paragons of the First Amendment. And now all of that's gone, and you have people like Justice Kagan, who basically espouses this very leftist, collectivist sort of viewpoint. And where is the left? Where is true liberalism? Where is somebody to truly speak out for the First Amendment and free association and free speech and not being forced to join private organizations? Because I suspect if somebody said to the professor, you must contribute to the NRA or to the Episcopal Church because they perform benefits for you, and if you don't contribute, we'll fire you from your professorship, we'd probably hear a lot of screaming about the First Amendment. So my question is, the philosophical question, where is the true allegiance to the First Amendment anymore in this country?
Well, this is Sam Bagginstaff. Since I may be the only liberal on the phone call, I presume this is directed at me. Let me say a couple of things about that. Number one, I want to say leave religion out of this. Of course, I know that my own tax dollars do go to pay for school voucher programs that put money in the hands of religious organizations all the time. And we know from the Supreme Court that that's not a violation of my First Amendment rights as it's currently interpreted. So I think let's be clear about what the First Amendment interest is here. Even Justice Black and Justice Douglas did not accept every First Amendment claim that came before them. The real question is what is implicating and what is violating the First Amendment. And here I would point you to Eugene Volokh's piece, as I said, just in the last 24 hours on the Volokh conspiracy, someone who I think nobody in Federalist society would doubt his bona fides as a defender of the First Amendment, says, hey, wait a minute, you know, there are a couple of different things that we're conflating here, right? So forcing someone to be a member of an organization is a kind of forced association that I think a lot of people, including myself, would say violates the First Amendment. Forcing people to spend money that will go to defraying the costs of something that is providing me a benefit, you know, we may have political objections to it. We may feel this is this is an impingement of our liberty, it's hardly an imposition on our free speech. It's not an imposition on my free speech to force me to spend money that goes to an organization that is engaged in simply workplace representation of me. I might not like it, but that's something different. The case law here coming out of Abood is case law that draws a very clear line between spending money that goes to representing me in my workplace and adjusting my workplace disputes and spending money that goes to broader political issues. So it deals with the question of the NRA. So I guess, you know, from my perspective, what I would say is, look, we have to go beneath slogans here, and we have to ask, what does free speech mean, and is this something that is an impingement on free speech? And I know there's a great deal of disagreement about that. I would suggest that, from my perspective, the free speech rights of public employees, as a public employee myself, are exceptionally important. And one of the things that I was saying at the beginning is very important, right, which is that when I speak out, or when a public employee speaks out in a way that leads to retaliation by his or her boss, by his or her public employer, the Supreme Court has said that there is a doctrine that divides between speech as an employee, which is subject to discipline and retaliation, and speech as a citizen, which is not. And applying that First Amendment doctrine here, the kind of speech that one's money is being used to support is clearly speech as an employee. So I think it's quite consistent. Now, we can have a really interesting conversation, which is probably not for this call, a really interesting conversation about whether the speech as an employee, speech as a citizen dichotomy makes any sense. If we're going to have that conversation, I would submit we should apply the same rules to cases in which a public employee is retaliated against for speaking out as cases in which a public employee has a little bit of money collected every month to support an organization that is providing workplace services. I really think that this is a matter of what are the relevant First Amendment principles here? I think there's clearly a divide on the court about that. I would suggest that the majority of the court is being inconsistent in how it treats the speech of government employees that gets retaliated against versus the speech of government employees in the form of exactions of agency fees.
Andrew Grossman, do you want to weigh in here?
Sure. If you look back just over the past couple of years, I think one of the most interesting phenomena has been in the state of Wisconsin, where there has been, public demonstrations on the streets for a month at a time regarding public sector benefits, public sector wages, and unions and union members have been involved, in that discussion. It's something that is closely related to collective bargaining rights in that state. It seems difficult to me to say that those kinds of discussions, which go hand in hand, with the issues that are at play in collective bargaining, how are public workers regarded? What are the terms of their employment? How does that affect the public fisc? What is, the state's, what are the state's obligations to its employees, and how can it negotiate with them? What topics should be part of that negotiation? All of these questions are things that touch on fundamental issues of public policy, and those issues become only more acute, as our government has grown, in terms of its size, and as our fiscal problems in recent decades have mounted. So it's really the kind of speech that more and more is taking place in public and has really become part of a very heated public debate. To take just a portion of that and say, well, that's not exactly speech on an issue of public interest. It's not really political speech that's subject to the First Amendment's highest and greatest protections. It's something that instead we can assign effectively to a third-party labor union, and channel your speech through that labor union in large measure, and force you to support that labor union's views on these vital issues of public interest and importance. That just seems to me very strange. People are out on the streets, hollering and screaming about these things because it's serious and it matters to the public. Those are the kinds of things I think we normally think are in the heartland of First Amendment protection. And it, as a practical matter, I think that's what the court's decisions in this area are coming to recognize more and more.
You have time for
We don't have a follow-up. We don't have another question online, so go ahead.
Okay, so I just want to sort of clarify, because I was coming at it from somewhat of a philosophical point of view, and that is, so to pick up where the professor was, he says, well, this is a benefit, and you know, you have to pay because you're getting a benefit. But the question, as I see it, is who gets to decide if it's a benefit or not? What if I'm a public employee and I've been beaten down by this particular union? They're negotiating for things that I would not negotiate for. They're negotiating for seniority and I want a higher salary, or they're negotiating for a higher salary and I want seniority or whatever. I mean, who gets to decide if something is a benefit? Does the government and a private organization get to decide that? Or where is my sphere of individual liberty and autonomy where I get to decide as an individual what is a benefit to me? And I think that's sort of the philosophical issue in all of this, is who gets to decide what's a benefit? And I suspect that if I came to the professor and started telling him what was a benefit in his work life, he probably wouldn't like it.
So let me just respond, Sam Bagginstos, quickly to the follow-up and a couple of things about this. I mean, so one, the question is, if I disagree with, if I am represented by a union, thanks to the Michigan Labor Board, I can't be represented by a union if I wanted to be. But if I were represented by a union, and they took a position in bargaining with the state over my terms and conditions of employment that I disagreed with, then I would not be stopped at all. Nothing would stop me from going out on the streets and saying this is ridiculous, from writing op-eds, from speaking fully. We're not talking about suppressing the speech of people who are members of a bargaining unit. We're talking about when a majority of members of the bargaining unit vote to select a bargaining representative. Pamela Harris's bargaining unit voted not to select a union as a bargaining representative. But when a majority of members of a bargaining unit, when a majority of workers vote to select a representative, are the people who benefit from that collective bargaining process going to be forced to defray some of the costs, their share of the costs? It's not about limiting their ability to speak. And so then the question is, when do you get to decide as an individual? I think that is an interesting philosophical question. And I think, you know, we can have a philosophical debate about it. It's not a debate about free speech. It's a debate about collective bargaining. It's a debate about whether individual bargaining or collective bargaining over terms and conditions of employment is an appropriate way to go. And, you know, that is an issue that has divided people for a very long time in the United States and elsewhere. In many places, including in much of the United States, in the private sector as well as in the public sector, recognized in the private sector through the Wagner Act and other statutes, society has come to a conclusion that it makes sense to have collective bargaining as a way of kind of equalizing bargaining power between two sides in a negotiation that otherwise would not be equal. Now, if you have collective bargaining, one necessary consequence of it, and this is what leads to the labor peace concern that Andrew was talking about, one necessary consequence of it is you have a single bargaining representative that's supposed to be fairly representing a large and potentially diverse group of people. If the group of people is sufficiently diverse that they feel like they're not going to benefit from collective bargaining, they can vote not to have a bargaining representative. But if they vote to have a bargaining representative, one consequence of a collective bargaining regime is there will be trade-offs. And on particular issues, it may be that some workers will win and some workers will lose. I might like merit pay, not seniority, or vice versa. I might feel I'll do better. And only one regime is going to be chosen for the workplace. I will say that even in the absence of collective bargaining, that may happen, Right. So in the absence of collective bargaining, and what may happen is the employer effectively gets to dictate those terms and gets to decide we're going to have a seniority system. We're not going to have a merit-based system, or we're going to have a merit-based system, not a seniority system. And I might have no say in that. I don't have any say in my salary and my benefits, for example. So I think this is a really interesting argument. And it's an argument that people can have a lot of views about, but it's not an argument about the First Amendment. It's an argument about collective bargaining.
Andrew Grossman, any final thoughts here? I'm going to give each of you 60 seconds to wrap up, and then we'll adjourn.
Sure. Just a response to what Professor Bagginsos just said. I think the problem, though, and the point that it's so easy to overlook is that, you know, in the absence of a collective bargaining regime, one wouldn't have to pay directly for the expression of those views. I mean, that's really the fundamental issue, and that's what the courts are focusing on here, is the direct imposition of being forced to associate oneself with views with which one may disagree, and to being forced to fund those views. And again, these are views on matters of the utmost public significance and the utmost public interest. So it's no small thing. People go to great lengths to associate themselves with particular views regarding fiscal policy and union rights and all sorts of things like that. They go out in the street and they protest. And people hold these views very deeply, and they're very substantial and significant to themselves. So, it really is a substantial imposition to force somebody to throw their lot in with the labor union and to effectively subsidize and be associated with arguments that may violate their most deeply held principles and beliefs as to the way that our government and our country ought to be run. That's what the court's decisions have been recognizing increasingly, that certainly the view that's taken in Harris, that this is a substantial imposition. And, I think, those of us who care about those kinds of rights and are troubled by those kinds of impositions should take some solace in the fact that in the next couple of years, the court may be prepared to remake this area of the law. That's something we'll have to see. Thank you.
Thank you. Professor, a final thought?
Thanks very much. I think this has been extremely interesting. Obviously, the Harris case raises very far-reaching issues that are going to divide people both in the judiciary and in politics for a long time to come, and I'm happy that we had a chance to talk about them.
Well, I appreciate the participation of both our experts today, Andrew Grossman and Professor Bagginsos. Thank you both for joining us, especially to discuss a case that was decided only yesterday. Also to our audience, thank you for joining us. A reminder that our next scheduled conference call is tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, when we'll be visiting with Professor Philip Hamburger. He has written the provocatively titled book, Is Administrative Law Unlawful? He'll be joined with commentary by Adam White. That, again, is tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.